I'm sort of call myself a bit of an ambassador for the microbes, so sort of informing people that most microbes are actually good, and actually through the power of microbiology, we can actually do something and actually harness that power of positive microbes to actually do something positive in the world.
Welcome to the Debate at Geo8 podcast series. Today we'll be focusing on those tiny living things that are found all around us, but are too small to be seen by the naked eye, microbes. They live in the water, soil, the air, and in our bodies, and they are the subject of world-leading research by our podcast guest today, Professor Chris Greening. He and his team are undertaking important research at the Greening Lab, which is based at the Department of Microbiology at the Monash Biomedicine Discovery Institute in Melbourne. And for that detailed work on the tiniest of things, he's been awarded one of the biggest, most prestigious awards any researcher can receive, the Prime Minister's Prize for Life Scientist of the Year. Quite an achievement for a man who's still in his 30s, but has some definite views about how research should be approached and the issues facing those looking to solve some of the world's most pressing problems. Hello, my name's Ron Candelars. I'm a freelance journalist and producer. And throughout this series, we've been canvassing a range of topics, touching upon the work of all the Group of Eight universities. They include the Australian National University, Monash University, UNSW Sydney, the Universities of Adelaide, Melbourne, Sydney, Queensland, and Western Australia. Also joining us in the Podbooth studio is the CEO of the Group of Eight, Vicky Thompson. Well, firstly, Professor Greening, congratulations on the Prime Minister's Prize for Life Scientist of the Year, an amazing achievement. And it really revolves around much of the work that you've done with microbes. Can you fill us in a bit more detail, please?
Yeah, so what a lot of my research is focusing on is basically how can we use microbes to tackle some of the biggest problems in the world. So we made this somewhat serendipitous discovery about a decade ago that microbes can literally take up the tiny amounts of hydrogen and carbon monoxide in the atmosphere and use that as an energy source. And now what we've been doing is actually finding ways to harness that to tackle some of the biggest problems in relation to both climate change, biodiversity, and also to some extent the energy sector as well.
Which is quite remarkable because we're talking about something that's so tiny we can't see it, yet the impact on our world is quite profound. I mean, obviously, microbes, some are good, some are bad. Can you talk to that, please?
So when most people think of microbes, actually, they tend to usually think about the sort of negative side. So they normally think of microbes as pathogens, and obviously the COVID pandemic hasn't helped there, and it's resulted in a very germphobic society. But actually, the majority of microbes are really positive for the world. So they were the first life on Earth all of those billions of years ago, and they're sort of our distant ancestors, like really, really distant ancestors, if you want to think of them like that. But they were also responsible for everything from forming our soils to providing most of the oxygen we depend on to breaking down so much of the pollutants in, say, wastewater. And also what we find is that microbes are responsible for providing so many products too. So they underlie our food system in all sorts of ways. They provide all sorts of medicines, but they also underpin so much of our biotechnology as well.
So given they are so important, why is it that we don't know more about them?
I think there's a few things. I mean, obviously they're invisible, they're demonized, and they're just poorly understood. But I think going back to education, I'm not sure about yourselves, but when I was educated, I learned a lot about animals and plants. I learned almost nothing about microbes. Maybe I was super dumb or something, but I didn't know about the difference between a bacterium and a virus until I was probably about 18, maybe 16. You know, we weren't taught about those differences. And then when it comes to the media, equally, there's just this poor understanding. So what I see myself I'm sort of call myself a bit of an ambassador for the microbes, so sort of informing people that most microbes are actually good, and actually through the power of microbiology, we can actually do something and actually harness that power of positive microbes to actually do something positive in the world.
So are you hoping then through the award that you've received, the very prestigious award, that it'll shine a light and on this particular issue, but also, you know, you're a relatively young person from where I'm sitting, use your expertise to sort of try and maybe influence the science curriculum and back into schools and that sort of broader area?
Exactly. We're hoping to do that. So we've got two major initiatives at the moment in a sort of education space I'm just contributing to. I'm only part of it, and these are being led by education-focused academics. So one is through the Center to Impact Antimicrobial Resistance, and we have a big program there focusing on trying to improve school curricula. But the other is through this International Microbial Literacy Initiative led by Ken Timmis, and that's all focused on basically trying to find ways in schools to inform children from an early age about microbes, but also ultimately empower them to realize we can use them in all sorts of ways. They are harnessable, even though they're obviously invisible.
Now, obviously, you're talking about a change in perceptions about microbes. And as I said, they seem to get a bad rap. Do you think too many of us look to sterilize our environments in the name of public safety? And in doing so, we wipe out many of the microorganisms that are so vital to good health?
It really depends on the context. So I think over-sanitation is obviously a bad thing, but especially in the context of, say, some of our most contaminated urban environments, we do need some sanitation, but it's really important that that sanitation is informed by the science. So one of the things that we've been working on, again, through the Center to Impact Antimicrobial Resistance, is that some sanitation agents actually are promoting antimicrobial resistance. So finding ways to actually ensure that if we are going to sanitize a surface and all of that, that's actually improving the issue rather than contributing to the problem.
And Ron, I was just going to say that's probably got worse thanks to COVID, where we were all quite paranoid about almost over cleaning. And just anecdotally, as someone who's just gone through a bout of low-grade pneumonia, you know, are we seeing more illnesses and viruses? It's a bit of a, I mean, I know that maybe this isn't your area of specialty, but certainly doctors and others that I talk to, almost coming out of COVID, we've become so paranoid that we're now seeing a resurgence and longevity in different sorts of diseases, et cetera.
Yeah, and the overall influence on the COVID pandemic on epidemiology is just so profound and varied, and possibly that sanitation issue has some things to do with it. Also, obviously, long lockdowns and all of that just meant that our immune systems didn't necessarily get the exposures we normally would to various things. And so I think we'll see a lot of really interesting science coming out in the next few years around that area.
I wanted to drill down a bit more in terms of your career. I mean, you're still in your 30s. And you've been given this very prestigious award, the Prime Minister's Prize for Life Scientist of the Year. You've talked about your interest in our ancient ancestors' microbes. Where did all this begin?
Yes, it's a really good question. So when people asked me when I was a kid, I'm not sure if you got asked this question and maybe you knew instantly what you wanted to be. But for me, when people said, what do you want to be when you grow up? I literally had no idea. It was only sort of through stumbling through things, I ended up going into biochemistry first and then microbiology later. And it was only in the late stages of my PhD when I realized, wow, this is actually really awesome. And it was when I realized, first of all, you can actually use science to discover whole new knowledge. But then a little bit later in my career, I realized there's actually really tangible pathways to actually use that knowledge and translate that to do something great in the world. So it was exhilarating, but the reason it took me so long, I think, is just the way that science was taught, for me at least, or at least how I perceived how it was taught, was that science was very much about learning facts, about rote learning. And if someone told me from an early age, actually through being creative and thinking a slightly different way, that's actually a good thing. I might have actually got onto that journey a little bit earlier. So what I focus a lot on my own education is just really trying to empower that next generation and realize science can be really powerful, but also you don't necessarily have to fit the classical mold if you want to make an impact in science.
That's really interesting. I mean, I will just say, I don't know how you stumble into a PhD talking to two very non-academic people here.
But you graduate from undergraduate.
Yeah, I'm waiting to stumble into one.
the global financial crisis is when I graduated, and I was overqualified from almost any sort of average job. And then the jobs, there was just nothing available. So I I literally decided there's nothing else for me. I'm going to do a PhD. If I'm going to do a PhD, I'm at least going to go to a different country to do it. So it worked out very well in the end, but I had probably the very worst motivations for doing a PhD.
Well, it clearly all worked out in the end, as you say. I'm really interested in that intersection that you just talked about in terms of creativity and science, because I think the two are often seen as quite separate, you know, strains, sort of in terms of themes rather, in terms of how science is taught. So first of all, maybe talk a little bit about that, but do you think that we are seeing now in science education that bringing together of science and creativity?
I was always really into the arts, but I just didn't see a way I could get a career out of it. I was a musician. I wasn't a good enough musician that I could join an orchestra.
I just have to interrupt. What did you play?
I play piano and also saxophone. So
fantastic.
Yeah, and I still play, and it's one of my sort of reliefs in life, but I'm so glad I didn't go on to be a musician. But with science, there's a whole range of ways to do science. People have different motivations. Some people are very data-driven. Other people are very solutions-driven. For me, I'm usually more questions-driven. So usually I look and just see an interesting question. So how I stumbled into all of this work on bacteria living on Earth, for instance, was just a very, very simple question, which was, why can microbes live for literally centuries without the organic foods that we need? And that led to a very simple but quite unexpected solution, is that they're literally taking up the tiny amounts of hydrogen and whatnot from the atmosphere. And that required me having a bit of creativity to sort of A, question that sort of conventional dogma, but B, also use techniques that would allow me to discover those sorts of things. And these days I really just try to endlessly synergize in everything we do, that sort of conventional, sort of very quantitative science, with that sort of more subjective creative element, if that makes any sense. And I try to encourage others to do the same, because there's so many unanswered questions, and to address those unanswered questions, there's so many different approaches we can possibly take. And then finding those solutions is going to lead to so many unexpected things. But at least in my own curriculum, I found it was usually very, very heavy on that rote learning, that sort of tried and tested sort of formulas. And I think often, to be honest, the education system is often designed for conformity. And if we can really try to encourage kids from an early age to really promote that higher order thinking, you know, asking them instead of to recall something, instead to create things, that's a really good way to, you know, bridge together, as you say, the science with sort of wider creativity. And, you know, the sciences and the arts are more similar in many ways than people conventionally think.
Which brings me to, I want to drill down a bit on the way in which your creative thinking has led to potentially profound breakthroughs that impact on things we would never have expected. Because when I looked through some of this material, I thought, wow, you know, your research being undertaken by you and your team could deliver the answers to many of the world's most pressing problems: climate issues, infectious disease, public health, energy. When I first saw that, I thought, that's a big call for something so tiny that we can't see. So just tell us, you know, briefly about how some of this research can impact on things like climate change.
Yes. So for climate change, usually when people think of climate change, they think of cars and fossil fuels and all of that. But actually, about 30% of all global warming is caused by the gas methane. And the majority of that gas is actually produced by microbes. So microbes in places like the owls' stomachs, things like rice paddies or wetlands and all of that. And it's not that microbes are necessarily problem here, it's more that humans have just massively increased the number of niches. But given most methane is produced by microbes, it's actually critical to use microbiology to address that problem. So for instance, what we're doing is working closely with the agricultural sector and finding ways to administer inhibitors to actually reduce that methane production. So just as you would treat a person with antibiotics if they've got an infection, we can add an inhibitor to the feed of cows, and then that reduces their methane production quite substantially. So we've been doing a lot of work with a major company called DSM there. But likewise, what we can also use is those microbes that eat up methane. So the so-called methanotrophic microbes who actually recycle some of that methane that's already been put into the atmosphere and then put that into carbon and soils instead, or alternatively capture some of the methane that's being produced in, say, wastewater treatment, and then use those microbes to convert that into sustainable plastics or single-cell proteins. So there's lots of different ways we can actually use microbiology or alternatively exploit microbes to actually deal with this major problem.
And you've been working on other research that looks at using microbes to help resolve issues to do with energy. Tell us about the HUC enzyme.
Yeah, so HUC is an amazing enzyme. So going back to that sort of thing I was saying earlier, how do bacteria live for literally centuries without organic foods? HUC was the solution. So basically what they do is when they have no organic foods, they switch to taking up the tiny amounts of hydrogen from the atmosphere, and they do that using that specific enzyme called HUC. And so what this basically does is when you purify the enzyme, it literally allows us to take energy straight from the air and then convert that into electricity. So that sounds pretty magical. It's sort of like Tesla's dream finally sort of discovered. The reality is that scalable? Is that the solution to the world's energy and climate issues? Sadly, not. The reality is that HUC is just a little bit too slow to really make a major dent there. But what it's still doing is pretty amazing, and it will have niche applications, whether that be in terms of air-powered devices or in terms of fuel cells that have a more dirty stream of gas for them. So HUC is pretty amazing for what it fundamentally does, and it does have applications, but sadly it's not going to transform our energy sector.
But still, it's energy from the air, which
exactly.
which no one would have thought of.
No, and exactly. And for me, when it came to that solution of how do microbes survive for so many years, I never thought that the air was the solution, you know? And most people think of the air as a source of oxygen for what we breathe, or a source of nitrogen for nitrogen fixation, but we never think of it as a source of energy. But there's a little bit there, and it's enough for microbes to take over, and it's probably enough to say if we want to have air-powered devices that we could manufacture them.
Which brings me to a big issue as well. This notion that, you know, you come up with these amazing findings from creative thinking, from blue sky sort of research. Do you think that the way we currently fund research enables people like you to do that? Or do you have potentially a warning for governments about the way in which we don't appropriately fund current research in the way that we should to resolve some of these pressing problems for humanity?
Yeah, exactly. So I think you really hit the nail on the head that a lot of the greatest breakthroughs in the last century have been through that blue sky research. Think of PCR, think of CRISPR, arguably think of HUC. These all were serendipitous discoveries that came from people asking very simple questions, and then that led to amazing discoveries. So some of what we do, we talk to industry, we talk to communities, we talk to farmers and ask what's the biggest problems you're dealing with and how can we help? And so there is that applied research that happens that's super important, but equally that discovery research where you're doing science for the sake of it can lead to some amazing insights. So more broadly, I mean, I've been very fortunate personally in Australia that the Australian government through the NHMRC and ASC has supported my research from a fairly young age, and that's enabled me to both have impact and translate those findings. But I do see a lot of amazing people who do sit through the cracks and not as fortunate as I am. And if there's any way we can increase that funding for both fundamental but also applied research, that could actually really make a big difference to Australia and enable us to pivot even more into that sort of innovation-based economy.
I mean, this is always the tension, isn't it, between funding basic research and particularly with government funding, and I guess sort of understandably government is looking for the outputs of research, widgets and gadgets and things, and a really strong push for commercialization. And one of the kind of startling, I think, statistics for, or at least funding for Australia is that investment by business into R&D has been declining, whilst investment by higher education and universities has been increasing. And at the Group of Eight, we're working really hard and getting, you know, relatively good traction with Treasury and the Department of Industry on how do we actually establish a roadmap to get us to at least 3% of GDP expenditure on R&D. Because at the moment, I think we're sitting at about sort of 1.7%, well below the OECD average. And I guess my question to you then, Chris, because, you know, you are quite remarkable. That's obvious from talking to you and your history, and you're very young to have achieved what you do. And I know you are also working with a lot of PhD students. I think you supervise a number of students, which is also remarkable in and of itself. Do you see any roadblocks, I guess, to our R&D? You've been fortunate, as you've said, but it's still a hard road for researchers constantly applying for grants, almost reaching a funding cliff almost annually sometimes. You know, will I be funded for the next round? What do you see as the barriers to research broadly, not just in your own area, but for those young researchers up and coming, of which you are one, but your PhD students, and where we sit really internationally?
It's a very difficult problem to solve, but I would say the biggest problem is public perception, and that also, of course, extends to government perception as well. So people just don't realize the importance of science and how that can solve many of the biggest problems facing both Australia and the world. And you go to countries like Germany or Israel or Japan, and that's completely different over there, where they celebrate the science as front and center. People have that knowledge of that. So if there's any way that we can collectively try to shine a brighter light on science innovation and just how important it is for finding solutions, but also for our broader economy, that I think would go a long way. And that's a very long road to face. But I would say that is the biggest stumbling block overall. I mean, Australia has world-class universities. Like, the research, the talent here is just incredible. Likewise, there's amazing medical and amazing fundamental institutes that are dedicated a lot to translating our science. But the broader, I think, perception of science in Australia is pretty low compared to a lot of the rest of the world. So if we can collectively find ways to improve that, then I hope that would go at least some way to people realizing this investment is worth it and will come back in major ways for the benefit of Australia and in just so many different areas.
I mean, this is what we are trying to do through these podcasts.
Yeah,
and exactly. You know, we talk about this with nearly every researcher, and it is a huge issue in terms of perception. And unfortunately, perception usually leads to reality in terms of funding. Governments are very political, and look, I understand they want to see bang for their buck. But you know, you mentioned other countries, and you're quite right in terms of Israel and Germany and other European countries. So do you think it's cultural? I mean, it's such a big issue. And, you know, I've been around this sector now for over 20 years, and we were saying this 20 years ago, and we make little breakthroughs with people like yourself who are coming up, and you can influence young people. I just wonder how we actually do that. It just almost seems insurmountable.
Yeah. Well, I think you're right that what we need to do is target people from an early age, and I mean target in a good way here, but really, once again, going back to our education programs, really emphasizing just how creative science is, but also enabling, empowering people so they realize they can use science to make a day-to-day difference. And I think often when we think of science, we normally think of universities and research institutes, but so many people are applying science in all sorts of different ways and day-to-day basis, but they probably don't even necessarily realize that. So if, again, it's changing that wider narrative and that wider perception, and I think that next generation who are so worried about the current problems in the world, I mean, at least for me, the world has never been as miserable and depressing as it currently is. Actually, you know, educating them but also, again, empowering them to realize that through science and obviously other things as well, it's not just science, we can actually find amazing solutions for some of these problems. And that depends on not just traditional scientists and people from traditional backgrounds coming through, but actually finding some you know, people who don't think like everyone else, people who are coming from non-traditional backgrounds.
But Professor Greening, one thing that strikes me, though, shouldn't we kind of call this out for what it is, that, you know, at the end of the day, there's been a big debate in this country about the reliance of scientific research on money generated by international students, you know, that formula. And we've seen the damage that happens when those international students disappear. So at the end of the day, isn't this really a question of a reshift in government focus about, you know, 3% GDP dedicated to science, real funding dedicated to people like yourself to resolve some of these issues, you know, really nailing what the essential problem is? Because otherwise, as Vicky mentions, it's a 20-year drift.
Yeah, exactly. And so if we can get towards that 3% GDP, we're matching other OECD countries, many of which have at least superior translation of the science than we do, frankly. And it would go a large way. And you're 100% right that over-reliance of international students has been sort of what universities have been forced into. But ideally, if as a society and through government support, we can better invest in our research and education programs, this would be ultimately for the greater good in the long term.
So I just want to round this off with a bit of a discussion about your latest research at the Greening Lab. What are you working on currently?
Oh, there's quite a few things, but a lot of the most exciting work we've been doing is much more in that translational space. So we talked a bit about the methane work and how we've been partnering with agriculture, but also waste companies to tackle that methane problem. But then many of our biggest directions at the moment are really revolving around partnerships. So we are involved in two major international programs. So Securing Antarctica's Environmental Future, which is all focused on how are we going to protect an entire continent in this case from the impacts of climate change and other pressures, and also the Revitalizing Informal Settlements and Environments program focused on Asia, focusing on Asia Pacific, so especially Indonesia and Fiji, where there they have colossal problems associated with infectious disease and how we can actually develop infrastructure together with the community. So this is all very community embedded, so that this problem is no longer causing the deaths of 500,000 children every year worldwide.
So looking at your website, I noticed that, you know, you obviously have an out-of-the-box approach in the way in which you think about a lot of these issues. When you're working with your PhD students, and you talked about a whole range of different issues there, what are you asking of those young, bright minds?
Going back to sort of what we discussed earlier, what we tried to do is recruit a diverse team and then empower them so that they feel confident enough in their abilities that they can do good science and hopefully make a bit of a difference. And really, it's about finding the very best fit for a PhD student to a project. So some PhD students are much more motivated by social issues. And so in that case, working on the Asia Pacific community-based projects is perfect for them. Others are much more traditional fundamental scientists. So asking them to start looking in more depth at, say, a particular enzyme or something like that could be perfect for them. But usually when PhD students start, they start fairly fresh. Usually they have a lot of capability, but they don't normally have that much confidence. And it's usually
was
about
your
working
experience?
With them to build that.
Was that your experience?
That was definitely my experience. Yeah. So going into PhD, I was so fresh in so many ways. I didn't have much lab experience, but I didn't really understand how real science worked. And I had the benefit of a great mentor, Professor Greg Kirk at the University of Otago. And he just constantly, I didn't understand at the time why he did this, because I think like many others, I had a quite significant imposter syndrome, but he always instilled this amazing faith. And I just in 3.5 years working with him, I went from this, you know, pretty miserable person in many ways, at least that's how I perceive myself, to being, you know, optimistic, pragmatic, being really quite bold. Like, he was one of these people who had relentless faith. He was one of these people who, in addition to being an awesome scientist, would like run ultra marathons and do crazy things like that. And but he wasn't just confident in himself. He had confidence in his people, and that rubs off. And so now I take a little bit of that recipe too. I can't run an ultra marathon, but you know, and use that to hopefully inspire the next generation as well.
Well, Professor Chris Greening, congratulations on the groundbreaking work you're doing at the Greening Lab, and congratulations on the Prime Minister's Prize for Life Sciences of the Year. You've had an amazing career. Long may it continue, and long may you get the funding that you require to continue that work. Thank you for your time today.
No, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks for your company today. If you'd like more information about the issues raised in this podcast or other related topics, please visit our website at go8.edu.au. And a quick reminder that you can always tune into the debate at GO8 on Spotify, Google, Apple, or YouTube. Bye for now.